This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 51 was recorded 2 days early this week on Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. Our winter all-star guest lineup continues this week as Louis Vincent Gav from Hong Kong-based institutional advisor GavCal Capital joins me as this week's featured interview guest. Louis and I will be discussing the significant economic events of 2016, and then we'll consider how their outcome translates to a market outlook and investment strategy moving forward into 2017.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna. Eric, that S&P 500 once again broke out to a fresh new high. What are you thinking here on where this is going next?
Did it go over 2,500 yet? I say that only half jokingly. It seems like this melt-up is just crazy. And I think what's driving it is everybody's focused on President Trump's emphasis on tax reform and growth and corporate profits and so forth. Wait a minute. What about protectionism that's being ignored? And I think that we're in for a rude awakening here. But as I've said so many times before, I've thought that before and been proven wrong. So this market still does not make sense to me. I'm on the sidelines because I don't understand it. How much further it has to go up from here, I don't know, but it doesn't make any sense in my book.
All right, now let's move on to that U.S. dollar index, decisively now holding above that 101 handle and continuing to progress higher. It's particularly, obviously, on the breakdown of the euro. What's your thinking here on the dollar index?
Well, the previous cycle high, or recent high, I should say, was 101.75. We fell back to 100.4. Just this morning, we almost got back to that 101.75. I think we hit 101.60. Now we're back to 101.35, something like that. You know, we need to see probably 102.50 to 103 to really confirm that the rally is back on. And I think that we're seeing a tug of war here. Donald Trump needs a lower dollar. It's essential to his objectives. But his policies are dollar bullish. So it presents a paradox. How does it get resolved? We'll see. I think it gets resolved to the upside. I know Louis Gav has an opposing view, so stay tuned for that when we get to our featured interview.
All right, Eric, let's move on to crude oil. You know, no matter how much bearish news seems to be coming out on oil, we have this technical breakout attempting all the way up toward the 55 level. What's your thinking for the next stage of oil?
Well, you're right, Patrick. We did actually see a very brief spike over 55. 55.03 was the high print. That was, however, the April contract, and the contract rollover contributed slightly. So the March contract, which actually expired today, never quite made it to 55. It was about 30 cents of contango between those two contracts. Now, we don't have any inventory numbers to report this week because we're recording the show 2 days early on Tuesday. Inventory normally comes out on Wednesday morning at 10:30. As it turns out, this week it's delayed because of the holiday until Thursday morning at 11 a.m. What we do have is the Commitment of Traders reports telling us that we have now reached yet another all-time high in speculative long interest. That's hedge funds betting on the price of crude oil going up. Now, in fairness, I should mention a caveat, which is that all-time high statistic is as measured in barrels of oil, not in dollars at risk. The number of barrels of oil is, in fact, an all-time high. But if you go back to the summer of 2014, there were more dollars involved because each barrel of oil cost twice as much as it does now. And this is happening at a time when we're actually at an all-time record high in stocks of both crude oil and gasoline. So we've got a huge amount of oil and gasoline in storage. More is piling up every week. We don't know this week's numbers, again, because it's a couple days early this week. The spike up this morning to 55.03 was on the back of OPEC rhetoric. So far, it looks to me like a blow-off top. We're down to 54.36 as we're speaking on Tuesday afternoon, just before the close. And it's amazing to me that OPEC has so much influence. If Jeff Bezos came on CNBC and said, you know, I expect Amazon stock to double or triple in the next 6 months, everybody, including the most junior retail investor, would see through it instantly. Okay, obviously, his personal net worth is tied up in Amazon stock. He's talking his own book. He's got a conflict of interest. Take it with a grain of salt. But when an OPEC minister who's just as conflicted says, well, we have no particular evidence to back this story, but it's going higher, it's going higher, everybody believes it. It just blows my mind. The thing to watch this week is going to be inventories when they come out at 11 a.m. on Thursday. Now, remember what's happened. For the last 4 weeks, we've had very, very bearish inventory data. What happens? The market goes up in reaction anyway. Why the heck is that happening? I sure can't figure it out. Well, if bad is the new good, does that mean good is the new bad or good is the even better? You know, what happens if we actually saw a drawdown this week? Would that send oil prices to the moon? I think it's very important because we're right at this technically important resistance level. The prior high on this cycle was 55 spot 24 back on January 3rd. If we were to see the price on the back of bad inventory data spike higher as it has for the last few weeks and stay above 55 spot 24 for more than an hour or so, that would beget more buying. And, you know, we could potentially see a momentum-driven grind higher and then short covering would come into play and we could see a short squeeze and, you know, the shorts get squeezed out as more and more longs pile in. I think it all eventually leads to a blow-off top. Did we just see the blow-off top this afternoon, or is there going to be another leg up before it's over? I don't know. We'll wait and see what happens.
All right. Well, let's move on to gold. In the face of U.S. dollar strength, gold has now twice rejected that 1245 level and has got a little bit of a bounce off the lows today. Where do you think gold's going next?
Well, I'm still on hold here because my view of the dollar and feeling that it will strengthen considerably from here tells me it's not time for gold yet. Now, I could be wrong about my dollar view, in which case I'm late to get into the gold trade. I should have bought it at 1125. I'm going to hold out here. I'm going to wait and see what happens. I'd like to be long gold. I'd like to actually increase my long dollar exposure. But right now, we're in this holding pattern of trying to figure out whether Donald Trump's desire to weaken the dollar is going to somehow be implemented despite his very dollar bullish policies.
All right, let's move on to interest rates. Those 10-year Treasury yields tested that 2.5 level last week and rejected off of there. Do you think that that's going to be where the Treasury yields peak out?
Well, you know, we had, I think it was 2.64 was where they peaked a month or two ago. And what is going to be the action from here? I don't know. It feels to me like we're still treading water. I don't see a clear signal. I do feel that, you know, the end of the 35-year bond bull market is a just huge, huge event that we all need to be closely watching for. Has it really happened or is there one more leg before this thing is over? I can't decide. I'm waiting to see what happens. I'm on the sidelines until I can figure it out.
Well, thanks for the market update, Eric. This week's featured interviewed guest is Louis Vincent Gav. He's the founding partner and chief executive officer at GavCal. Please stay tuned after the interview as Eric and I will be back to discuss the considerations in investing in the stock markets at the late stages of the business cycle. Eric's interview with Mr. Gav is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Louis Vincent Gav, of course, from a very famous institutional advisor firm, GavCal, headquartered in Hong Kong. Louis, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start by talking about you being headquartered in Hong Kong there. This whole China reflation trade. A year ago, the buzz was, hey, 2016 is going to be the year where China is forced to devalue markedly, and that will send a massive deflationary shockwave around the world. Well, it didn't happen in 2016. How do you see this? Is that really a risk? Is that the right story? What's going on with China?
To be honest, I think that's you're absolutely right. That's been one of the biggest surprises of 2016. I think if we look back at the past year, most people, and you talk about the surprises, most people talk about Trump and they talk about Brexit because this is what makes newspaper headlines. But you're absolutely right that a year ago, everyone in the dark thought China was going to implode. Instead of imploding, the government obviously re-stimulated the economy. You saw big spending from state-owned enterprises. You saw oil imports go up 24% year-on-year in the first quarter. Iron ore imports, copper imports, everything goes through the roof in the first half of 2016. And instead of imploding, China turned out to be a reflationary force for the rest of the world, to the point where actually today everybody talks about the Trumpflation and how the U.S. election has triggered a big reflationary trade for the world. For me, it's not as much Trump and what's happening in the U.S., really, at what occurred in China. We had another round of fiscal stimulus, just like we had in 2009, 2010. And this led to, you know, rebound in commodities, rebound in Baltic Dry Index, rebound in steel prices. Now, interestingly, I think if you project yourself forward now to this summer, China basically stopped stimulating around the summer of 2016. And in fact, starting in November, they started to tighten monetary policy, started to raise interest rates, started to lean on the banks to lend less. So if you project yourself to this summer, the big risk for me is that perhaps, now there's reasons to think that reflation trade will continue, and we can maybe go into that. But one of the risks is that as Chinese growth rolls over, as the year-on-year comparisons for China get tougher, what you will see in China is weaker growth starting this summer, and that might start to curtail the reflation trade you're seeing on the markets today.
So do you buy the story that we are returning to a secular increase in inflation, or do you think this is temporary and maybe going to roll over, as you said, in the summer when this reflation trade sort of runs out of steam?
I don't want to answer like a Jesuit and answer your question with another question, but it really depends. And to be honest, it really depends on what you think happens to the U.S. dollar from here. I tend to think that Donald Trump will do everything he can to make sure that the U.S. dollar does not go up. Because at this point, if Donald Trump wants to be reelected, and let's face it, most presidents want to be reelected, if Donald Trump wants to be reelected, he'll need to carry the Midwest, Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, et cetera, in the next election. The only way you do that is if you bring back manufacturing jobs. And the only way you bring back manufacturing jobs is if you get a weaker U.S. dollar. And today, you know, the U.S. dollar is too strong for U.S. manufacturing. And this is in the very first interview that Donald Trump made following his swearing in with the Wall Street Journal. His first point was that he wanted the U.S. dollar to go down. Now, if you think that Donald Trump will be successful in bringing down the U.S. dollar, and again, that's a big if, I happen to believe he will be. But if you think he will be successful in doing that, then yes, most likely inflation will pick up, especially here in the U.S., because everything you import from abroad will start costing more.
And it's interesting that you see it that way. I couldn't agree more that Donald Trump very much needs to try to accomplish a lower dollar. But a lot of people would say that the very policies that he's pursuing in order to achieve what you just described, getting manufacturing back into the U.S., he's really pressuring a lot of multinationals to repatriate assets to the U.S., which of course creates a dollar demand, at least in the short run. And I think a lot of analysts are seeing that as dollar bullish. Do you see it differently, or how would you explain that apparent paradox?
Yeah, no, I think that's the quandary and the big uncertainty in markets today. You're absolutely right. So if you're Donald Trump, you know the outcome that you want. You know that you want the U.S. dollar to go down. The question is, how do you get there? And do you get there by imposing protectionist measures on the rest of the world? Well, if you do that, as we saw with all the bashing of Mexico, you actually drive other people's currencies lower. So it's obviously not a great outcome for you. So beating the protectionist drum, again, as you've seen with Mexico, with the peso going from like 18 to 23 very, very quickly, becomes, in essence, self-defeating. Even if you say we're going to slap 30% tariffs on Mexico, if at the same time you have a 30% devaluation of the currency, you're right back where you started. So I think what Donald Trump will try to do, let's not forget he sees himself as a deal maker, is sit down bilaterally with country to country, and he's already started with Germany. I think he started to some extent with Japan, and you'll do the same with China. Sit down with country to country and say, look, you guys have to revalue your currency, or at the very least, your currencies can't go down anymore, or there will be protectionism and repercussions on your businesses here in the U.S. And so it'll be a give and take. Now, you can say, well, he thinks himself a deal maker, but that doesn't mean he is one, and he won't manage to bully other central banks and other governments into changing their policies. There is a historical precedent for this, of course, which is the mid-80s. In the mid-80s, the Reagan administration got everybody together in Paris. You had the Louvre Accord, the Plaza Accord, where every central bank and every big ministry of finance agreed to basically prevent the U.S. dollar from rising any further after the huge rise of the early 80s. And this triggered an enormous boom in emerging markets. It triggered an enormous boom in Japan, because back then, just as in today, one of the big risks for investors when you deploy capital in markets, in emerging markets, or back then in Japan, was that the currency would go down. Take away that risk, and all of a sudden, not only local investors, but foreign investors as well, find the valuation gap prevailing in all those markets extremely compelling. You know, if you look at Asia today, we're trading roughly at 11, 12 times earnings against 18 times for the U.S. The reason for that partly is fear of currency devaluations. You remove that fear, and all of a sudden, you get a massive boom all around the world. And with that, I think an outperformance of the rest of the world and the U.S. dollar that stays capped. So this is, by the way, the same thing that you saw in 2003 when Bernanke came out with his famous helicopter speech. That was the starting gun for a massive emerging market boom, because once again, the biggest risk in emerging markets very often is that the U.S. dollar goes up. Remove that risk and you get tremendous boom.
And a lot of analysts have been very concerned about this massive debt overhang that has grown in China since 2008. Kyle Bass probably being the most outspoken, saying that, you know, it all has to blow up and it's going to force China to markedly devalue in order to recap their banking system. Do you see this overhang of debt in China as big of an issue as some people are saying, or do you have a different view?
I have a different view. Now, no doubt, debt has grown in China. And it is not a healthy development. You know, like most other countries in the world, China has seen a much faster growth in its debt than in its GDP. I mean, if you look at the U.S. as an example, under President Obama, total government debt grew by $7 trillion U.S. dollars for a $1 trillion increase in U.S. GDP. So it is not just a Chinese phenomena. It's everywhere around the world. You're seeing a faster increase in debt relative to growth. So, you know, you could say everywhere, this is really a negative development. Now, when it comes to China, I think when you look at potential debt crises, you have to remember that debt crises come in one of two forms. The first is you have a country that basically lives above its means, that runs large current account deficits for years, and that becomes on the willingness of strangers to fund that debt. Now, this is not going to happen in China. You know, foreigners have not been funding Chinese debt. So this sort of Argentine or Greek or Spanish scenario where one day foreigners wake up and say, you know, I don't want to buy any more Greek bonds, I don't want to buy any more Argentina bonds, isn't going to happen in China for the simple reason that foreigners do not own any Chinese debt today. Foreigners have not, the entire increase in Chinese debt has been funded wholly by Chinese savings. So then the question becomes, can you get a second kind of crisis? And the second kind of crisis is you get a real estate boom, and banks love lending to real estate, and banks one day basically outgrow their own deposits. They need to get more money to continue the lending, and so they borrow short to lend long. They borrow money from money markets, they borrow money from bond markets, and basically that way lies perdition, because borrowing short to lend long is a very leaves your balance sheet extremely, extremely threatened at the first sign of a potential reversal. And so the question is, you know, could we have this kind of crisis in China? Well, no. Well, not yet, at least, because Chinese banks today are still funded almost exclusively on domestic deposits. So the only scenario you can get to a bank crisis in China is massive bank runs, that basically the mom and pops decide, I want to take my money out of the bank. But frankly, that's a scenario you can make anywhere. You know, if tomorrow I tell you 30% of Americans will want to take their money out of American banks, and American banks will go bust. And the same in France and the same in Sweden. And so the way you have to conceptualize Chinese banks today is that, yes, they're poorly run institutions, but they're actually extremely conservatively run institutions. They're not very levered. They have very high reserve requirements. And if you look at total Chinese debt, it's equal to one-time bank deposits. If you look at the U.S., it's 2.5 times bank deposits. So, you know, the reality is China can still leverage up, because the leverage is a fairly new and recent phenomena in China. Now, of course, the pace is quite fast, but because you start from such a low base, you can still go for quite a while.
Let's go around the world to the site of the next major event of 2016, which, of course, was Brexit. Some people feel that that last rally in the bond market might have marked a top and the secular bull market in bonds might be over. Some people are saying that the EU is doomed, that Brexit was the beginning of the end. Other people are saying it's just a flash in the pan and nothing to worry about. How do you see the significance of Brexit? And let's expand the question to what's your outlook for the future of the European Union?
Oh, we could spend hours on this one alone. Look, I think Brexit was the first sign, indeed, that the European Union is a doomed project. It's basically, I think England was right. It's, you know, basically pulling the plug on a project that doesn't work. When you see the economic misery in Greece, the economic misery in Italy, the economic misery in Portugal, it is obvious that the European construct has failed, if not the majority, at least a very significant proportion of the European population, where if you look at Italy, standards of living, GDP per capita, stands at basically below where it was 20 years ago. Same for Greece, same for Portugal, etc. So it's the European Union has been a failure. And so Britain decided, you know what, given this failure, we'll be heading out now. Thank you. We'll be checking out. Now, does that mean that the unraveling of the European Union is upon us? To be honest, I think it's going to take a long time, partly because so much political capital has been invested in this. So many careers, so many bureaucrats are tied up and heavily invested into the European Union that it's hard to see it unravel in just a year. Now, you could say, well, the unraveling really started 5 years ago with the European crisis, and we're just going through the motions. But you have, you know, as an investor, what we have to realize is there's a lot of embedded interests which will fight tooth and nail to keep this thing going, not least of which, of course, the European Central Bank, which, given its printing press, does have significant powers. So making money on the breakup of the European Union is not an easy task. What it does mean is that structurally, while this, you know, this construct is still going on, the European Union is not a great place to deploy capital. And frankly, if you look at the relative performance of European equities today, we're at the same low levels as we were in 2012 and 13 in the midst of the European crisis. Europe has been a bad place to deploy capital. Now, I actually think that cyclically, for the next 6 to 9 months, Europe will most likely do very decently well. European equities, I think, in the next 6 to 9 months will do very well. So it's a good cyclical trade on the back of stable oil price, weak euro, easy monetary policy, and perhaps a political risk that today is overplayed with the fear of Marine Le Pen, which I still don't believe will be the French president. So once, you know, it becomes clear that Marine Le Pen won't win, you'll probably get a relief rally. But structurally, you know, for me, Brexit and the doomed European Union means that structurally this is not a great place to deploy capital. Cyclically, you may want to play some rebounds here and there, and the next 6 months could be a good opportunity. But structurally, I still think that Asia is a much better story than the European Union.
I want to touch on another international development. So many eyes were on Brexit in the EU, but around the world, back in the Philippines, they elected a new president, Duterte, who has basically kind of told the U.S. to get lost and is reaffiliating that country with China. And it makes me wonder, is this just one guy who's got a crazy attitude, or is it maybe an indication of things to come in terms of U.S. foreign relations? And you know, what does this mean for the Trump presidency if long-time alliances are kind of switching teams, so to speak? And do you see more coming along the same lines?
I do see more coming. You're absolutely right that for me, Duterte's election was actually a very big deal. Because here was a guy running in the Philippines. Now, you know, put this in context. The Philippines has historically been one of the staunchest U.S. allies across the Asian Pacific region. It's a very key geostrategic point because you control all the eastern side of the South China Sea. U.S. has historically had military bases there or military presence. And, you know, it used to be a U.S. colony. So the ties between the Philippines and the U.S. go way, way back. Anyway, This guy runs Duterte during the election and during the campaign. He basically says, look, China's been encroaching on our reefs for the past 5 years. We're obviously not going to go to war with China because we don't have a Navy. We don't have an Air Force. We'd get our ass kicked. So instead, we've asked the U.S. for help. But really, the U.S. is an unreliable ally, and they've done absolutely nothing for us. So what I'm going to do as soon as I'm elected, I'm going to go to Beijing. I'm going to sit down with Xi Jinping, and I'm going to tell him, look, you can keep these islands, but against that, we want investments in ports, airports, power plants, roads, railways, basically the infrastructure that the Philippines lacks today to be a genuine first world nation. Because actually the Philippines has a decently educated population. They've got an English-speaking population. What they clearly lack is decent infrastructure. And so Duterte gets elected and sure enough goes to Beijing and turns around and then tells the U.S. to get lost. Now, this is a massive coup for China. You know, Xi Jinping, since he's arrived, has been very clear that China now had imperial ambitions. See, if I could summarize Xi Jinping's program in one sentence, I would say that Xi Jinping's main goal is to make China great again. He sees China as the center of a broader Asian empire in basically all China's neighbors tied economically to Beijing and to the Chinese economy. Now, empire building is fundamentally a road building exercise. You know, there's a reason in Europe we say all roads lead to Rome. Empires build roads to bring commodities in cheaper and push finished goods out to the outer realms of the empire. And when you listen to Xi Jinping, all he talks about is One Road, One Belt, the Silk Road Fund, the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, so on and so forth. And so the Philippines, you know, moving away from the U.S. empire into the Chinese empire, for me, is a big deal. It's a sign of things to come. And another big domino that fell this past year has been Malaysia. Now, one interesting point on this is, you know, the U.S. administration, if you remember President Obama's pivot to Asia, the core of the Obama administration was to try to contain China with a big trade agreement with all of America's friends around Asia, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And, of course, the first thing Donald Trump did when he came in was to put the Trans-Pacific Partnership into the bin. So imagine if you're a country like Indonesia or a country like Thailand, and a year or two ago you were told, you know, don't side with China, stay with us, we'll give you some trade deals, it'll all work. And then the next guy comes in and says, no trade deal for you. Meanwhile, China is knocking on your door and saying, hey, how would you like some money to develop roads, to develop power plants? It's pretty easy to see why more and more countries are deciding, well, maybe I should play the China card after all. So for me, you know, this rise of the Chinese empire is one of the single most important macro developments. The Duterte win really crystallizes the switch, and yet in the Western world, very few people are talking about it.
Another big event of 2016 was over in India, where 80% of the outstanding value of the currency system was taken out of circulation when they retired the largest denomination banknotes. This is a story that's obviously very, very significant there, but didn't get a whole lot of press coverage in the United States. So what's going on there? What's the motive? Why would they do this? What are the consequences? What does it mean?
Yeah, I said it was 85%. So it's basically equivalent, if you think of the U.S., it'd be equivalent of the government turning around one morning and saying, hey, the $100 notes and the $50 notes are no longer legal tender. You got 2 or 3 weeks to bring them into the bank to get smaller notes. And by the way, if you bring in more than $10,000 in notes, you better have a good explanation as to why you have so much money. This is pretty much what happened in India in November. And yes, it took most investors by surprise. You had a 20% dip in the Indian stock market, and I think, frankly, also a dip in gold, as a lot of Indian entrepreneurs were scrambling for cash and thus had to either sell some of their equities or sell some of their gold to basically pay the parallel payments that they often have to make. Now, why did Modi do this? I think in every emerging market development curve, all emerging markets, and this is true also, by the way, of Singapore and Hong Kong, Taiwan, the successful emerging markets, start off with a decently high level of corruption. Why? Because, frankly, corruption helps grease the wheels of the system. It helps economic activity move on. You know, if you think of the U.S. doesn't have much corruption, but it has an extremely costly legal system. Lots of lawyers, lots of judges, time spent in courts, etc. Now, this is, of course, it is good to have such a strong judicial system for an economy that can afford it. But if you're a poor economy, you can't afford to have all these lawyers, judges, etc. And so corruption comes in and allows business to move forward without all the legal apparatus that weighs down the economy. However, you get to a certain level of growth and corruption, instead of helping growth, starts to hinder growth. It starts to basically mean that you can only do business with people you know, not people you don't know. And it becomes a real break to potential economic development. And I think this is why China's gone through a massive anti-corruption drive in the past 5 years. The other sentence you could use to describe Xi Jinping is, you know, he's put more than 40,000 senior party members in jail. So clearly he's been draining the swamp. And I think Modi is seeing his role as something similar. Corruption in India today is a real issue. It does prevent economic growth. And how do you tackle it? Well, one way to tackle it is to do like Xi Jinping and put 40,000 people in jail. However, in India, you know, the government doesn't have the same autocratic advantages that you have in China. And so that's not really an option. So he came up with the next option. Well, let's target cash, which after all is the number one way to get corruption done. And now I think for India, in the short term, it obviously put a big hit on the economy. It was a hit, a self-imposed hit that came out of nowhere. I think for the long term, it's actually positive. It's a positive development, and hopefully one that will allow India to basically, you know, become more efficient in its use of capital, whether human capital or physical capital. It'll allow people to not work just with the people they know, but, you know, broaden out the economy and give more opportunities across the board to all the young people that are now joining the Indian economy.
I wanted to start with all those international topics because I know that you guys cover them so well. But let's come back to the United States, because we saw again this morning yet another record all-time high on the S&P 500. And the view of investors seems to be that Donald Trump's deregulation and tax cut objectives just have to spell up, up, and away from here. It seems like nobody's paying attention to all of the talk of protectionism. So I wonder, how do you see this Trump rally, or I guess I should start by saying, do you agree with the view that that's what's driving it? And does it keep going, or is this a blow-off we're setting up for? What's happening here? And perhaps related to that, do you think at some point the dollar rally has to be stopped, a Plaza Accord 2.0 or something like that?
Yeah, great questions, and I wish I had the answers. The way I look at it is I think people are focusing too much on Trump for the overall global rally, because it's not just in the U.S. You know, since the beginning of this year, emerging markets have massively outperformed the U.S. You know, and Europe and Japan are also doing okay. So it's a global phenomenon. It's not just a U.S. phenomenon. So look, I like tax cuts and I like deregulation as much as the next guy. And I do think the U.S. will see deregulation. I think the tax picture is cloudy. And it may be a while until all the ducks are in a row to get proper tax cuts in the U.S. So here, perhaps you could say the market's getting ahead of itself. But for me, the big rally, which is really a reflation trade rally, you know, outperformance of materials, outperformance of cyclicals, outperformance of emerging markets, really rests on two things at this point. It rests, one, on the stimulus that you got in China and that led to a rebound in Chinese growth that, frankly, the market was not expecting at all. In fact, the market was priced for the opposite. It was priced for a big slowdown out of China. Instead, we've got a reacceleration of growth. But it's a reacceleration of growth that risks fading from this summer onwards. So, you know that puts a brake on your global reflation trade starting this summer. Your second I think, catalyst for this, the next move up, was Donald Trump's speech on the U.S. dollar. As we discussed before, You know, if the U.S. dollar is now capped, if you believe the U.S. dollar no longer rises, then yes, the reflation trades everywhere around the world make sense. And the market could rip higher, just like the markets ripped higher following the Louvre and the Plaza Accord in the mid-80s. And we could be in such a phase. If the U.S. dollar starts moving back up, however, and at the same time we start getting dodgier numbers out of China, then all of a sudden the global picture will look a lot more daunting. And even with deregulation in the U.S., even with tax cuts in the U.S., I don't think it'll be enough to carry the market. But for now, you know, we've got a U.S. administration that basically says U.S. dollar is not going to go up, and a Chinese government that has been stimulating the economy. So you've got the two largest economies in the world that are sending fairly positive signals. Add to that, you know, some decent data coming out of Europe, which, you know, has done very little for 5 or 6 years, and the scope for a decent cyclical rebound in Europe, even if structurally there remains a lot of headwinds, as we discussed earlier, a decent cyclical background for Europe. And, you know, the background isn't that bad. Decent growth in Europe, U.S. keeping the dollar in check, and China re-stimulating, that makes for a pretty powerful combo on a lot of cyclical asset classes like emerging markets, materials, and all the other reflation trades.
We've touched now on equities and the dollar. Let's also include the other big asset class that you talked about in a recent piece that we're going to send to our subscribers, which is both U.S. Treasuries and other OECD bonds. What's your outlook for fixed income?
Well, look, I think if the reflation trade is on between, you know, it's already started, if like me, you believe it goes into the summer, then you know, there's no real reason to jump into bonds today. You know, why do you own bonds at the end of the day? I think you own bonds for one of three reasons. Either because they offer tremendous value. And for us, it basically means real rates of above 3%. When you get real rates of above 3%, you just back up the truck and you buy bonds, because that's, you know, the best structural growth rate the economy can reach. So if bonds are offering you higher rates than the structural economy can offer you, then, yeah, you should back up the truck. Today, obviously, we're not there. You can also buy bonds if you think inflation and growth are going to be rolling over. That's when bonds really outperform. And the third reason you buy bonds is to diversify an equity portfolio. Now, if you look at today, you know, real rates aren't at 3%. Almost, it's hard to find real rates of 3% anywhere in the world. Growth and inflation are most likely still in an acceleration mode from now till the summer. And so, again, as the inflation data ticks higher, as the growth data ticks higher, why would you really want to buy bonds? And then the third option, of course, is to diversify equity risk. And, you know, that's true at any one point. So really, for me, I look at bonds today and I think, well, the risk rewards just aren't that great. But come this summer, they may start to look a lot better. Because if I'm right about Chinese growth flowing over the summer, then all of a sudden some of the inflation data that we've seen, some of the growth data that we've seen could well start rolling over. And if bond yields have picked up a little bit more by then, the valuation will be more interesting. So on bonds, I think I'd be patient and start to go back in at some point this summer.
Something I really enjoy about the way you guys think at GavCal is you break your investment thesis into three categories: carry trades, mean reversion trades, and momentum trades. So let's just go through each category, starting with carry trades. What do you see? Where are the opportunities here as we look forward into 2017?
Yeah. So the reason we do this, by the way, we split our investments into basically three baskets, is because you have to be very clear in your head as to why you're buying something. If you're buying something because it has terrific momentum and it's a growth story, and you know you think something is going to the moon, when the momentum turns, then you should just get rid of it. But if you buy something because you think it's very cheap and it's a good attractive asset that the market is underpricing, and the market then goes down another 20%, then instead of selling it, you should buy more. And really, carry trades are, I think, it's the one basket where timing is especially important, because you know changes in yield curves, changes in interest rates can move carry trades from being an attractive diversifier to your portfolio to all of a sudden being a source of significant capital losses. Now, there's no doubt if you look at the past 6 months that, and that, by the way, predates Trump's election, because yields really bottomed in the summer, that the market has been moving away from any kind of carry trade. Anything with a yield has really been getting crushed. And for the reasons that you and I just discussed, it may still be that, you know, picking up yield over the next few months, given the pickup, this continued rise in inflation and growth, you know, chasing yield will not be a very profitable endeavor. Still, I think, you know, coming into the summer, you'll want to have more yield in your portfolio. And today, you know, where can you find yield? Well, you can still find it in U.S. MLPs, which should benefit from the energy sector deregulation in the U.S. So that, you know, that's one interesting area potentially. Same really with Canadian REITs. As you get more energy deregulation in the U.S., as you get the Keystone Pipeline, et cetera, as the Trump administration makes it easier for Canadian oil to flow down into the U.S., that should be good for the Canadian dollar. So Canadian dollar REITs, Canadian dollar yields, I think, are interesting. And then, you know, beyond that, we've been long, you know, steadfast owners and believers and investors in the Chinese RMB bond markets. My view is that it's very simple. If China wants to be an empire, it can't do it on somebody else's dime. It has to do it. It has to basically transform the RMB into Asia's trading and reserve currency, which is what, of course, they're gradually doing. It is, of course, the reason they're opening up their bond markets and their currency markets. You know, if you're a Chinese technocrat, control freak sitting in Beijing, why would you give up control of your interest rates and exchange rates? You obviously do it because you think that there's something better on the other side. And something better is turning the RMB into a reserve currency. Now, as the RMB slowly, gradually becomes a reserve currency, and we saw China join the SDR a year ago, as the RMB slowly becomes a reserve currency, what you have is an opportunity for Chinese bond yields to continue moving down and down and down. And one of the interesting things, if you look at the past 5 years, if you'd invested $100 in Chinese bonds and $100 in U.S. treasuries, you would have done a whole lot better in Chinese bonds, even with the currency devaluation, simply because of the higher yields that prevail in China. So as I always tell our clients, look, if you like your bonds to come with a yield, then China's not a bad place to look. The problem, of course, of most of the world today is that too many of the bond markets come with too little yield. And thus, instead of reducing your volatility in the portfolio, reducing the risk in your overall portfolios, bonds today actually increase the risk, because when bond yields are at 1% or 0.5, the slightest change in yield has a massive impact on the capital value of the bonds. So, you know, today, I think if you're chasing yield, you have to chase yield in emerging market debt, whether in India, in Indonesia, in China, all of which are very interesting to me. And if you're constrained to the U.S., then I think things like MLPs, Canadian REITs are interesting.
And what about mean reversion and momentum trades?
So mean reversion here, the idea is you're looking for assets that are unloved, possibly contrarian, mispriced, and basically being abandoned by everyone. And on this front, you know, I really like Hong Kong equities that are trading close to record lows in terms of price to books, in terms of PEs, and definitely relative to U.S., very much at record lows. So I think Hong Kong equities are very, very cheap, and that reflects partly the poor political situation that we've had in Hong Kong for the past few years. So that's one. Number two, I really like the Mexican peso at this level. You know, the Mexican peso has got to be one of the cheapest currencies. It's obviously gotten beaten up big time by Donald Trump's election. The news flow in Mexico has been terrible. But, you know, with the Mexican peso at 22 or 23, it is a currency that is now severely undervalued, putting Mexico at a comparative advantage for a number of its manufacturing industries and whatever else. And the other one, a little bit like that I really like is sterling. You know, I think basically anybody who was long sterling has now thrown in the towel. Everybody, all the financial flows have come out of the UK and out of the fear of Brexit and the Brexit uncertainty. And meanwhile, I think there's a good chance that in the next year, France and Germany get together and give Britain a decent deal, because the weak sterling is killing French farmers and killing German automakers. And French farmers and German automakers are each respective country's biggest lobbying groups. And both those groups are now lobbying government aggressively, saying, hey, we can't live with the sterling where it is, so do something about it. And the only thing those guys can do is give Britain a halfway decent deal. And as soon as the deal gets struck, I think the sterling will bounce back 15% pretty quickly.
And momentum trades?
Well, you know, the momentum trades, you know, we discussed some of them. You know, U.S. equities, of course, are strong. And I think a lot of the reflation trades that are going on are still probably going to go strong till the summer. Now, my big fear is that come the summer, we have a big turn in the momentum. But for now, you know, we have to stand in awe of the momentum, both on very cyclical sectors like materials, cyclicals, consumer cyclicals, on technology, and frankly, on financials. I am, of all these sectors, the one I probably like the most at this point is financials. Not only, of course, are they big beneficiaries of the steepening yield curve, but more importantly, you know, financials have really spent the past 10 years, almost 10 years, cutting their costs, getting leaner, dealing with an extremely hostile regulatory environment. And now, you know, the regulatory environment is changing for them. You can expect that they won't be getting massive amounts of fines as they did for the past 8 years or so. And the productivity of the individual worker, you know, most banks, you look at them, they've slashed their workforce in half. And a lot of them are doing more business today than they were back when they had double the workforce. So the productivity of the individual worker has really gone through the roof in most financial institutions. And so, you know, after 10 years of consolidation, after 10 years of cutting costs, I think financials are quite interesting today.
And, of course, in addition to those three legs of investing that are all designed to make money, we also have to think about hedges in case something goes wrong. So what could go wrong in 2017, and how would you hedge against it?
So many things could go wrong. You talked about protectionism. We talked about China trying to roll out an empire and potentially overstepping its bounds and creating tensions around the region. We've got Saudi Arabia today that's basically fighting a war on three different fronts in Yemen, in Syria, in Iraq, and losing the war pretty much on all these fronts, and funding itself through a very low oil price that already is not high enough to sustain its own domestic budget. So, you know, if you were looking for things to go wrong, one of the things that could easily go wrong is a budget or even a social crisis in Saudi Arabia and the potential toppling of the government that would, you know, either mean $10 oil or $200 oil. I think right now what Saudi is doing is it's trying its very best to keep the oil price above $50 so that it can get the Saudi Aramco IPO through the door at the end of this year or beginning of next at a $2 trillion valuation, which is what they're hoping to get, and hereby replenish the coffers of the kingdom that are increasingly bare. But, you know, if things start to go really wrong for Saudi, then, you know, holding that line at $50 and curtailing production may no longer be an option. Other things that could go wrong, of course, Europe, we've got a bunch of elections there, though I think that risk is perhaps overpriced in the market. We have an important political transition year in China. The overall consensus is that Xi Jinping will be able to consolidate and solidify his power base. But, you know, for all we know, that may not happen. So, you know, the main thing is, given all the uncertainties out there, I think you have to maintain a diversified portfolio, which is why you want some momentum trades, some return to the mean trades, some carry trades. You want to have a diversified portfolio, and you want to remain flexible. You know, as facts change, you change your mind.
Louis, throughout history, something that I've learned as I've studied history is that people who live through really exciting times, things like the Great Depression and World War II, they generally don't even realize it as it's happening. It's only when they look back on it that they can reflect on the enormity of it. You closed a recent research piece that you wrote saying that we live in revolutionary times. Give us a little bit of perspective on what you meant by that, and how do you see the world today?
Yeah, no, I was using a quote from Lenin, who, about the Russian Revolution, to your point, said, there are decades when nothing happens, and there are weeks when decades happen. That basically, you know, all of a sudden, a lot of things can happen in very short periods of time. Now, you know, the whole point of the revolutionary piece was to highlight that, and this has been a long theme of mine really since 2005, since I wrote my first book, Our Brave New World, that, you know, the structure of production in our entire economies have changed. If you go back to my parents' generation, you know, most people worked for big companies. So, you know, IBM would have had 300,000 workers, and Citibank would have had 300,000 workers. And basically, society was organized very much in a pyramid framework where you had, you know, tons of workers, and then a few managers, and then a few managers of those managers, and all the way to the top, like a pyramid. And if you go back to the 1970s economic books, you've got pyramids all over the shop, all over them. Now, today, of course, organizations are completely different. You know, they cross boundaries. They're much flatter, and you know, the days of, you know, managers of managers of managers are gone. Today, if you're the CEO, I don't know, of Unilever, you've got systems in place to know exactly at any one point how your sales in India are doing, how your margins in Australia are doing, etc. And information flows immediately straight back to the top. Now, our political system, we're organized to reflect this pyramidal, you know, these pyramid organizations. And very often, you know, if you look at Europe, when we change from being an agricultural society to an industrial society, you had revolutions because the political organization that reflected the agricultural society no longer worked for a society that moved to full industrial. As we've moved from industrial to service industry, again, you've seen some transformation in the political organization, but our political organizations still reflect really what we put in place at the time when the world was all organized along big pyramids run around big industrial consortiums. And frankly, you know, our economies have moved on, and I'm not sure our political systems have. And so I think we'll have, over the coming years, continued political upheavals. Maybe Donald Trump is a first symbol of that, and Brexit is another to some extent. And the good thing about democracies is it allows us to make these changes over time and gradually. You know, we can feel our way into the systems that we want to have. So I tend to believe that our democracies will prevail, but there'll be a lot of hit and miss along the way.
Institutional investors are very familiar with your extremely popular research notes, which of course are called GavCal Ideas. We have a sample of one of your excellent pieces written back in January, which actually covers all the topics that we discussed today in even more detail. A link to that piece has already been emailed to you in your research roundup email. But Louis, beyond that one, I know you've written several books. Tell people a little bit more about how they can follow your work and learn more about what you do at GavCal.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the plug. Appreciate it. The best way, to be honest, is to go to our website, gavcal.com. And that's GAVEKAL.com. And yes, we write different books. You know, we got a fairly big research team and analyst team. And on any given year, and usually about every 9 months, one of us will write a book on a topic. So right now, our latest book, written by my colleague Tom Miller, is called China's Asian Dream. It's a terrific book talking about, you know, what we discussed earlier, China's geopolitical reach. And I think it's, like I said, one of the most important macro developments unfolding today. That book came out just 2 weeks ago. So it's, you know, fresh off the printing press. People can buy it on our website. They can buy it on Amazon. They can buy it at their bookstores. But otherwise, yeah, no, go to our website. We have some free stuff on there. We give out free trials. Our research is mostly geared towards institutional investors. And so, you know, institutional investors should definitely sign up for a trial. And if what we do helps them to allocate capital, then, you know, they can sign up and subscribe.
Fantastic. Well, I cannot thank you enough for an excellent interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, again, another very interesting interview. I personally found his observations on Europe resonating with me the most, particularly when Louis suggested that European Union is a doomed project. What stood out for you?
Well, I really like the way the GavCal guys think. I happen to disagree with Louis on a couple of things. I see the dollar situation resolving the other way. But it's very clear that he understands the conundrum here. Donald Trump very desperately needs and wants a lower dollar. Now, Donald Trump's initial policies are dollar bullish, and I think Louis acknowledged that that was the case. Louis sees it as Donald Trump is smart enough to understand how important a weaker dollar is to achieving his long-term goals. He'll find a way to make it happen. I take the other view of I look at the policies that he's announced so far, and they're not going to make it happen. But I think we see the resolution going in different ways, but I think we both understand the problem in a very similar way. So I really enjoyed it. I want to mention, too, for our listeners that we have a download for you for what normally is only available to GavCal's institutional clients, and that is a copy of about a 30-page paper that covers all of these topics and quite a bit more that we didn't have time to get into in this interview. Registered users at macrovoices.com, you'll find the link to that in your research roundup email. If you haven't registered yet, just go to macrovoices.com, get registered, get logged in, click on the black menu bar and look at the research library. You'll be able to find the download for that GavCal research note, which I found extremely interesting. Now, Patrick, you said we had a listener request question that was worthy of discussion. So what's on your mind?
Well, absolutely. One of our listeners shared their current situation with us, and I felt it was really a scenario many of our listeners might find themselves in. So here's the quick summary. He recently sold his company for a respectable amount of money and finds himself sitting 100% in cash. He manages his capital himself. He is concerned about the markets, citing facts that many of our guests have repeatedly mentioned, things like high valuations, late business cycle, current monetary policy, etc. He wants to be invested for a 6 to 10 year time horizon, but is patiently waiting for a deep market correction to get into the stock market. So he asks, what would we do if we were in a situation with 100% of the capital on the sideline? And secondly, what are his alternatives to staying on the sideline? Eric, I'd like to start off the response in observing that many investors feel this way, largely because an entire generation of investors have been given the impression that investing is predominantly driven by the stock market and the decision is binary. You're either in or you're out of the stock market. Even the average investor, when they think bonds, thinks boring, fixed income, conservative cash flow. This is where investors can and should turn to macro by broadening their perspectives and looking at currencies, commodities, bonds, all as equal weight assets to stocks.
Well, this question really resonates for me, Patrick, because I remember seeing that email that you're talking about from a listener. I've also had two inquiries from prospective investors in my hedge fund in the last couple of weeks who have very similar stories. You know, they've sold businesses, they've made some money, and they're very concerned about entering a market with new capital at a time when it feels like we're at the late stages of a bull market. So I guess the first thing I would say, for any of our newer listeners who aren't aware of it, Aaron Chan and I put together a four-part series called Accredited Investor Academy, which is specifically designed for people coming into wealth who need to learn about the world of alternative investments and portfolio management and so forth. So if you are a newly accredited investor, I certainly recommend that you check that out at macrovoices.com/AIA, and of course, it's always free of charge. You cannot buy and hold stocks in this environment, unfortunately. It sucks, but it's true. And the problem is, I don't know how much longer this bull market has to go, but by almost any metric, it's long in the tooth. The business cycle is long overdue for a correction, if not an outright recession. So it doesn't make any sense to me to bring new money into this market and just, you know, put all of it into buying and holding stocks. I think you're probably going to be investing at the end of a cycle. Now, is the cycle end next week or next month or next year? I don't know. So I think that getting away from buying and holding towards more speculative strategies makes a lot of sense. But this is not something that you can afford to dabble with. You've either got to be willing to put the time and energy into learning how to do this, finding your edge and knowing what your edge is, and being able to make money by putting trades on, or hire someone else to do it for you. But you can't just play with it. You know, if you're talking about buy and hold investing, it's pretty simple. You've got more money, you put it in the stock market, you just leave it there until it's time to retire 30 years later. You can't do that in this environment, but you don't want to just play with it. You really need to learn an approach to speculating or trading that is going to work for you. My own approach has been to focus on something where I can make fully hedged trades. For example, spread trades in the term structure of the crude oil futures market, which I've talked about several times in the past on this program. In a case like that, you're long an equal number of contracts that you are short in a different delivery month. So you're betting on the difference in price between different delivery months, which is driven by things like storage and inventory and market balance and so forth. But it's a trade that is independent of market price. So if there's a big move up or down, you don't get hurt too much either way. So you've got to find something that resonates for you. And I would invoke what I call the Schwager Doctrine, based on Jack Schwager's books on the subject, which is you've got to figure out what style of trading resonates for your personality. For me, I have a passion for crude oil and understanding the dynamics of it, and particularly the term structure of the crude oil market. For someone like yourself, it might be options writing. Everybody has got to find their own style. You've got to know what your edge is. And if you don't know what your edge is, then you're better off on the sidelines.
Well, you know, I'd like to add to that. Once one explores all of the macro opportunities, they can look for the asymmetry in the investments outside of the stock markets. As an example, we've had a number of guests repeat over and over again that they suggested that we'll once again see 2% yields on the U.S. long bonds. If this scenario develops, there may be a manageable downside risk with clear double-digit returns on the upside. You know, in addition to that, throughout the year, there may be phenomenal return potential on being long U.S. dollar or discovering where the lows of gold may come. Each trade can be done without having to be stuck on the sideline waiting for the stock market to give you that reasonable valuation.
Something like long dollar or long gold is definitely a speculation, however, and plenty has been said and written about the pitfalls of speculating rather than investing. So I think we have a responsibility to again stress, if you're going to speculate when the alternative is buying and holding in the late stages of a bull market, there's nothing wrong with speculating, but it's not something you can dabble with. You've got to figure out what your edge is, you've got to know what your edge is, and you're better off on the sidelines if you haven't gotten to that point. And it requires a lot of investment of time and energy in order to learn how to do this. It's not as simple as just, you know, dollar cost averaging into mutual funds and, you know, not redeeming them for 30 years. In an environment like this, though, nothing is cheap. So what else do you do other than look for those macro imbalances? I would much rather personally accept the risks inherent to speculating after finding my edge than to buy and hold the stock market. Now, I haven't been outright long the stock market. I haven't had large equity exposure since about 2007. So that's 10 years now. People would say, well, you've missed it. I mean, there's been a tripling of the stock market in that time. Yes, that's true. But frankly, it had happened. I think we got very lucky. It happened as the Fed was playing chicken with quantitative easing, and a lot could have blown up. I was making money. I did just as well doing other things instead of investing in the stock market. And I would contend with lower risk. I don't know that that can be proven out as lower volatility, because this march higher in stocks has been almost a straight line. I think it's kind of crazy. But, you know, that could have all blown up. And I've instead been investing in the kinds of trades that we're talking about here. And I've done just fine. So it's a question of finding your balance. But unfortunately, what you can't do is just pick something and say macro instead of stock market, throw your money at it and forget about it and come back years later. If you're an accredited investor and you can invest in hedge funds, you can do that. If you don't have that ability, you've got to put the time into learning how to do this yourself. And it's not something that just comes overnight.
Right. Now, I also want to touch on the psychological hurdles of being on the sideline as well. One of the biggest obstacles of being a rational investor is that the market is rarely rational. You know, investing naturally attracts successful business people that can analyze the numbers and they can look at it and say, you know, this makes no sense. And the market can continue to go higher, rewarding the proverbial dumb money that is oblivious to risk, leaving many smart people watching from the sidelines. This creates immense emotional stress on people trying to rationalize their situations.
I think it's important to also understand how this works in the industry. I remember in 1999 or 2000 being at a conference, and this guy who was a fund manager was talking to the audience saying, you know, this is crazy. He says, I have a huge long equity exposure to tech stocks here. I know this is a bubble. It's so plain and obvious to me, but I cannot afford from a career risk standpoint not to be long and exposed to this because the other funds are going up 35, 45, 55% in a year. If I do what I've already done in my own personal account, which is go to cash. So this is a smart guy. He runs a big actively managed mutual fund. He's gone to cash in his personal account because he sees the risk. But he says, I can't go to cash in the fund. If this bubble continues and there's another 25% that the other funds make and I don't, and I've underperformed the index by 25%, it's career overtime for me. Now, I know what's going to happen. Sometime in the next year or two, this market's going to blow up and my fund and everybody else's fund is going to be down 50%. But because it happens to everybody at the same time, nobody gets blamed for it. If I do the prudent thing here and I go to cash because this market is nutso, then it's career ending move for me. So what I'm going to do is keep my personal money in cash and I'm going to risk my investors' money on something I know is going to blow up. And everybody in the room was speechless saying, well, yeah, he's kind of right. You know, you don't have a choice as a professional manager. If the market is melting up, you've got to stay with it because otherwise you will underperform and you'll lose subscriptions. And you know what you're setting your investors up for. It's certain doom, but they would rather do that than end their own careers. So it's important to understand what really drives this market. As far as how I personally deal with it, as I said earlier, I stay out of the stock market because I don't believe in the reasons that it's been melting up since 2009. And I look for other ways to make money. And so far, I've been pretty successful with that. But Patrick, you're in the business of teaching people how to trade. So how do you teach your members how to deal with this?
Well, you know, I always, when I talk about bubbles, it's like, it's not particularly hard to identify when the price of an asset is moving like it's in a bubble. But it is much, much harder of an endeavor to try to predict how high it can go and when the bubble is actually going to be over. Now, because the late stages of a market bubble can often be accompanied by this parabolic rise, you really have no effective way to use rational thought based on macro or fundamentals because it's purely a liquidity event. Often, I recommend members to continue to play the long side of the market, but to utilize call options rather than focusing on owning long stock or index futures. This is ideal because as the market is rising, volatility is actually low. And the option vol skew naturally has the calls relatively cheaper than the puts. This allows you to continue to participate on the upside with the call premium defining your maximum risk, while, most importantly, the majority of your capital is safely on the sideline in cash. You can keep just rolling the calls forward and while extracting your intrinsic value out of the options.
Now, that's an excellent point, and we could probably go on for more time than we have covering all kinds of different perspectives. Maybe we should do another post game on this subject on a future show. Unfortunately, we are out of time right now. Before we close, I do want to touch on something, which is you, Patrick Ceresna, are going on a speaking tour in Canada. You're going to be speaking in Western Canada cities. I think it's a 6-city tour, including Victoria, Vancouver, Surrey, Edmonton, Red Deer, and Calgary. So very briefly, what are you talking about? And I assume bigpicturetrading.com is the right place for listeners to find out more in case they want to attend.
Absolutely. I'm going to be doing a tour talking about generating options conservatively off of selling premium on covered call writing, selling puts, and doing all sorts of other interesting option strategies. But I'll also be talking about everything from macros to technicals, and just to kind of put the whole market into context here. So anyway, Eric, is there anything else you wanted to add before we close?
Well, we definitely need everyone's help. We're on a real roll here, folks. We had Jim Rogers. We had Jeff Snyder. Now we've got Louis Vincent Gav. These are some pretty big names. We've got another big name coming up next week. But the way we get them is because the more registered users we have, the more Patrick is able to negotiate to get the attention of these really prominent guests. So please retweet us when we announce each episode. Use our player embed if you want to put a Macro Voices player on your website. And most importantly, please go to macrovoices.com, register your free account. Benefit to you is that you'll get the research roundup email, which is a compendium of links to all the cool free stuff that we could find on the internet. And the benefit to all of our listeners is that the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best featured interview guests. So Patrick, what's in this week's research roundup?
Eric, in this week's research roundup links, you'll find Louis Gav's research report, Drawing Meaning from the 2016 and a Roadmap to 2017. You can also find the link to the transcript of the interview. Just as a housekeeping note, as always, it takes 24 to 48 hours for that link to get live. So if you're clicking it and it's not working, try again in 24 hours later. We also have a great article written by William Hess from PRC Macro, submitted a report on China, and particularly reviewing the property sector inventory update and outlook. In addition to that, we have a link to a Bloomberg article discussing Le Pen's gains in the French polls as security concerns win over voters. You'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and like to share the content with our listeners, please send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also directly follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.